and super excited for today's guest. This guy's become a very good friend over the last couple of years, someone I have learned a tremendous amount from, have a tremendous amount of respect for, and he really dives deep into the mental training. And as soon as I introduce him, and that is my good friend Spencer Wood, you will hear that he hails from Boston, Massachusetts. You'll tell immediately from the accent. Mr. Spencer Wood, thank you for joining us.
It is so good to be with you guys.
I definitely thought New York.
From Tunica, Mississippi, here is Spencer Wood.
Born and raised in Brooklyn.
This is perfect timing that we have you on, mental conditioning coach.
Yes.
Alan and I, we've been going hard today. You've been going hard. You spoke at a couple different clinics. We need to make sure we're mentally conditioned. Continue going. So no better person to have us be coached up than you.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to getting into some really good conversation.
Good. And for those that are a little twisted right now, where is this accent actually from, my friend?
This is actually South London, England. But for the past 23 years, I've called this great country home.
Awesome. But you still got the accent.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, when I go home, it gets a little bit thicker, and then I get chided quite a bit because a lot of my friends and some of my family members just say, you know, you are so American. My typical response is, thank you very much. That's a good thing.
Now, tell us a little bit more, because, you know, we don't do a canned bio here. I didn't want to just read off some arbitrary bullet points. Tell everyone a little bit more about what you do, you know, Icebox and everything that you have going on now, and then we're going to definitely dive deep into your journey.
Sure thing. Well, what I'm about to say sounds a little contrived and canned, but I'm being genuine when I say that I feel like I may be the luckiest trainer on planet Earth. I do what I love, which is talk about the mental part of the game and work with teams and different organizations across the country and in some cases really lucky around the world. And probably the easiest way to understand what I do, because it comes under a lot of different terms, sports psychology, mental skills trainer, mental toughness guy. Probably the easiest way to understand what I do day in, day out is, I use the phrase, when you trace the roots of athletic greatness, regardless whether it's a great individual performance or a phenomenal team performance, you'll typically see excellence in the same four areas mentally every time. And those four areas are typically called the four C's of peak performance. They relate to an athlete's composure, their concentration, their confidence, and their commitment. So what I'm privileged to do is work with teams and athletes and build drills and skills in each of those four key areas.
Where does this come from? I mean, where did you get this passion to be a mental conditioning coach?
Well, I was going to say, well, before you answer that, what do you prefer to be called? Well, he's called you a mental conditioning coach. What is your preference?
Spencer?
You
can call me Spencer.
Dr. Wood.
Spence is just fine to my friends and family, and I'm at PGC now, so this is friends and family to me. Yeah. So Spence is just fine.
But as far as a vocational title, what do you actually consider yourself?
You know, Alan, it's a good question. I like to steer away from the term sports psychologist for a number of different reasons. Typically, there are some medical and counseling and psychopathology implications connected to that term sports psychology. And I deal almost exclusively in sports performance. So a mental toughness coach or mental skills and toughness trainer works just fine. Awesome. And plus, that's a lot more palatable for the average coach and athlete. You start talking about sports psychologists, they think I'm going to throw them on the couch, give them a lollipop, and start talking about their childhood for 20 minutes, and that's not the case at all.
Right, gotcha.
So where do you get a passion like this? Where did it come from? When did you realize that you wanted to spend your time and vocation in this type of field?
You know, it's interesting. I say this because I wasn't a good enough athlete. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing right now. And I mean that with all sincerity. I was.
I can relate.
I fell in, even though I'm lucky enough to work with a lot of different sports. I actually play basketball. I played basketball in college, full scholarship, and got to play a little bit at the next level. And I can honestly say I just wasn't a good enough athlete. I had decent athletic ability, but not great. I had decent skills, but not great. And so I had to rely on every legal advantage I could get my hands on, whether it was great programming from a guy like Alan Stein to help with my speed, agility, quickness. And I don't mean that as a cheap plug. I mean, sincerely, I was heavily into SAQ work, the skills development. But I started reading like a sponge on the mental part of the game. And when I was done, I really wanted to formalize my education in this area and really spend a lot of time researching. I've just got a great passion for the field. And the more I researched, the more I worked, the better it went.
What were some of the resources you read?
Different sports have different, you might call in my field at least superstars. You know, a guy like Bob Rotella in golf has got some excellent resources. A guy like Ken Revisa and Hansen has got some great resources in baseball. Guys like Sean McCann has done some great stuff at the Olympic level with the USOC, has got some great resources. So what I learned is that there is amazing crossover from sport to sport to sport, that even though the nuances are very different, the way skills are executed, very, very different. Even the downtime in different sports. So you think about baseball for just a second, and the downtime when you make the transition from dugout to on deck, from on deck to at plate, very different than a basketball player. So even though the nuances of each sport are very, very different, the downtimes are very different, where the mental really becomes, it gets pushed to the forefront, particularly during downtime, which can be the enemy of an athlete. I'll say this, is that the sport by sport by sport, that makes it very, very interesting for me.
Now, at what point did you know that this is what you wanted to do? So you played in college, you started playing a little bit after college. When did you know that this is how you wanted to make your living and fulfill your purpose?
You know, I've got to give a huge thanks to a fellow called Dr. Scott Bryan. And when I was in college, and I probably shouldn't say this on air because I'm not sure this was actually allowed at the time, but he was very gracious. He had me teach one of his classes when I was in college. Now, it was a health-related class. It wasn't a sports psych class, but he wanted me to talk about the mind-body connection because he knew I had a great passion for this area. Once I was done with that class, it was a glorious but terrifying experience at the same time, because I probably wasn't ready to teach an actual class, but part of it was just delicious. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yes.
And it really made my heart sing. And at that point, I said to myself, this is what I want to do one day.
That's my new word, delicious.
Yeah.
it was delicious. I love that. That's great.
That is really awesome. Now, one thing that's always fascinated me about your work, when you're talking just about basketball, I know I've totally switched gears here. What's the most dangerous period of time for a basketball player?
Are you talking about dangerous as in preseason or dangerous during the season?
During a game. What is the time that most coaches don't pay any attention to? And I've heard you give this, you know, you speak about this at a couple different times that I've been around you. What is that time where most players don't understand how important the mental component is?
I think one of the most dangerous times is in the downtime, in the, as I call it, and I use the term 17 as a very arbitrary number, but in the 17 steps a player takes from timeout to free throw line or timeout to play action. And it's during that dead time, again, it's a very undertrained time. And it's during that dead time where a player is thinking many different things. And of all the routines we put in place in the game of basketball, when you think about the routines of the X's and O's of the sports, and you drill a certain offensive pattern, or you drill a certain defensive trap, and you drill it over and over and over again, and you hope that it's going to become a habit under pressure, under the bright lights and the intensity of the competition. And yet it is so critical that we shape the words that are in our mind and the images that are in our mind and the thoughts that are in our mind, how we react physically, mentally, and emotionally in those critical periods leading right up to a moment of skill execution. So you talk about a dangerous time. I'd say this is across all sports in a sense, Alan, but you see it more often in dead ball situations and coming out of timeouts where you've got a big play, and here's the critical thing. It's often what was going on in the mind of that athlete in terms of the words and the images in his or her head leading up to the critical moment of skill execution, which is going to determine the outcome of that play. And that's the part that's often untrained. Typically, after a timeout, it's hands in, it's 1-2-3 win, or it's 1-2-3 championship, or 1-2-3, whatever their mascot is. And that's it. And you can almost take this and put it into a time capsule where you slow everything down and watch this athlete walking in slow motion and thinking what the heck is inside his head or her head. That's the part that's untrained, and that's the part that's so critical for a successful pressure play.
So what do you try to pour into a player for that moment? I mean, what are some of the things you're teaching when you're actually working with your teams, you're working with your players? What are you having them think about? What exercises are you having them go through to help them in that moment?
There's a couple of things I really want to control. One of them is I want something in their head that's going to build poise, and it's going to build focus, and it's going to build confidence. So there are a couple of phrases that I use. One of them is called go-to sentences. I want one or two or three tough powerful sentences in their mind, such as, I'm at my best when it counts the most, love shooting in the clutch, leading up to a key free throw. And I want those phrases over and over and over and over to play, almost like the, you've got an iPod that's broken or a CD that's scratched, that's playing these phrases over and over again. And it's more than just building poise and focus. This part is critical. What it does is distract the mind and prevent it from shifting or gravitating towards consequences and outcome. And I can't stress this enough. When you look at why choking actually occurs in sports, typically it's when an athlete has the angel and demon just standing on their shoulders, having that conversation when they're really concerned about consequences and outcome. Again, I use the free throw because it's such an easy, simple example in the game of basketball, but you've got this key shot and that player is literally thinking, this is it. This is for the first trip to the state championship for my high school, or the first trip to the NCAAs for my college, or the first trip to the Elite Eight or the Final Four. But what if I miss? And all of a sudden, and they're trying to block that out, but the second they begin to dwell on consequences and outcome, pressure enters the mind. That threat, stress response enters the mind. And when that does, it wreaks havoc on the body. It affects our decision making. It affects our fine motor skills, coordination. Again, it's kind of a prerequisite for choking. So coming full circle now, I want to be able to carefully control and help shape exactly what the heck is going on in the mind of that athlete in those key 17 steps, the words and the images, not just to build poise and confidence, but also to be able to distract the mind and shift it away from consequences and outcome. If the mind is left to its own devices, it will tend to shift and gravitate to consequences and outcome. It's part of the human condition. If I put any one of us in a stressful situation, and sometimes the example I use is this gentleman, if I were to string up a high wire to the two tallest buildings in downtown DC, or downtown Atlanta, where I live with my family now, or downtown London, where I was raised. And I on the high wire, I gave them a balance beam and said, you get to walk across without a safety net. And if you fall, you fall. And furthermore, if you fall, someone that you love will suffer the same fate. Now, this is a horrible thought I'm putting inside everyone's head right now, and I apologize for that, but for good reason. If you're a caring, thoughtful human being, your mind, even for just a few seconds, will shift to the mangled mess for you at the bottom, and also to the person that you care about. And even just talking about this out aloud, so many of the listeners have actually just flashed to a key person in their life. Why? Because they're good people. And that's what the mind tends to do under pressure. It will shift and gravitate to consequences and outcome. The way we want to coach that, specifically to answer your question, Adam, again, is we want to distract the mind to stay present, is a very common term. Think about the process and put some things in place, again, that build poise and confidence in those moments.
Because you said the mind can only think at one thing at a time, right?
That is effectively, yes.
Yes. So your goal is to try and divert it from thinking about the negative things by intentionally and with purpose putting these positive thoughts into their mind.
Alan, that's exactly right. And there are some players and coaches that are a little bit resistant when it comes to that particular concept, because they say, you know what, I'm all about the win. That's what I want to do. I want to win. We're all about the win here, and we're driving towards the outcome. Well, forgive me for getting kind of cute with that acronym a little bit, but the true definition of WIN, W-I-N, is what's important now. And it's focusing on the variables responsible for the outcome that will actually give you the right outcome. But actually focusing on outcome is a very, very dangerous double-edged sword, because it's very difficult to actually focus on outcome without unfortunately having your mind also shift and gravitate towards the consequences of the outcome. And focusing on the consequences, again, is a prerequisite for choking. Now, that there are some players that you can look at, the best in the NBA. You know, you look at like a KD, a Kevin Durant, and you look at a LeBron, you look at a great clutch player, and even though they might not, I mean, maybe some can, but maybe some of them couldn't actually be in front of a mic and tell you exactly why or how they think the way they do. But trust me, they're putting something in place which actually focuses on what they need to be focusing on in that key situation, which is certain words. And play it's exactly the same after a mistake. It happens exactly the same after a mistake.
And there was the halftime buzzer, so let's take a quick break for today's PGC Basketball Halftime Talk.
Hey, thanks, guys. TJ Rosine here with PGC Basketball. See, you got Spencer Wood on today, one of PGC's best friends. This guy can teach the mental aspect of the game. He creates champions with his icebox athlete, and he's even a better person. One thing that I love about Spencer is that he focuses on what players need. And oftentimes as coaches, I know this sounds a little backwards, but sometimes we don't focus on what players need. If I ask coaches around the country what part of the game is mental, they say 40% or 50% or 60%. Some say up to 80%. Most would give me the answer somewhere between 50 to 70%. And then I say, well, how much time do you spend training that with your players? they say, oh, shoot, 3%, 5%. It doesn't match up. If the mental aspect of the game is that important, if it's 50, 60, 70% of the game, why don't we spend time teaching it? Coaches, this is a great question to sit down and ask yourself. Number one, why am I not teaching the mental aspect as much as I need to? Two, how do I teach it? And three, where do I get the resources to be able to teach that? I think we can help you with that at PGC, and I know Spencer Wood can help you with that as well. So think about that. How do you teach the mental aspect of the game and start being a teacher of the mental aspect of the game? Thanks, and back to you guys.
Big ups to PGC for their leadership in the basketball community and for their support of our mission here at the Hardwood Hustle. Please check out pgcbasketball.com to see how they can help you become the best player or coach you're capable of.
So obviously this is a basketball podcast, but I'm intrigued. Is it the same approach that you would tell a baseball player walking from the dugout to the on deck circle to the batter's box, or a golfer from the second shot walking up to the green? Is it the same process, or is it change at all because it's
field,
the basketball
field goal kicker?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The fundamentals are the same, but the way it's coached is very different, Adam. For example, if you've got a baseball player that's making the transition from on deck to at plate, that player needs to spend some time getting the pitch dynamics down, where they can see the release point, they can look at the velocity, they can get a sense of timing. And then at a certain point in time, you want the mental process to actually engage. Once they've got that down and they're ready, then the mental actually takes over. It's less about the mechanics of the game than it is preparing yourself. And this is critical, and it speaks to your question, you know, what's different about basketball versus golf versus baseball or any other sport? The timing of the downtime affects how you coach that. For example, in golf, you are really coaching the disengagement process in between shots and in between holes. Because it's the time in between shots that can wreak havoc on a golfer, where again they're thinking about where they're at in regards to the leaderboard, or and this is something that's not discussed very often, or they might have an upper zone of discomfort. We're all familiar with our lower zones of discomfort. What does that mean exactly? When we play poorly, we're anxious, we're frustrated, we're angry at times, but there are also upper zones of discomfort that you have to work with. And in golf in particular, it's really important to be able to deal with those upper zones. It means that if you've, for the first time in your career, that's 9 birdies in a row or 10 birdies in a row, or for the first time in your career, you're about to break 65. Or there was a professional golfer that I get to work with, and he's one of the only golfers in history to actually throw in a 59 in legit competition. Well, to be able to actually break that 60-point barrier, you have to deal with some upper zones of discomfort too, where you're getting really, really close to a lifetime best performance, and now the threat response kicks in. This is mine to lose. I could look really dumb here. Everyone say I had this very simple up and down for a 59 and I blew it. Or actually feeling like, you know what, the work I've put into my career to this date or my talent level, it, and I'm using poor grammar here for emphasis, it ain't a 59. And now how does an athlete get to talk themselves through that and actually deal with that upper zone of discomfort? And it could be the same thing for a basketball player who's never performed a certain way. You know, I think about, and forgive me for dating myself here, when I talk about what I thought was an amazing performance for a player that was seen, no disrespect to him, because he played in the NBA. I never played a second in the NBA. So when I'm talking about Scott Wedman of the Boston Celtics in the mid-80s against Showtime, the LA Lakers in the NBA championship. And here's a guy that comes off the bench and drills in this game 11 for 11. And basically wins the game for them. And it's amazing to me, not just by the fact the guy went 11 for 11, he was a journeyman, he was a role player for the Boston Celtics, but it's also the process he would have gone through. Can you imagine if you were Scott Wedman and you were 8 for 8 and 9 for 9 and having to break through some maybe some upper zones of discomfort to say, wait a minute here, this is against Magic.
Yeah.
This is against Kareem. This is against Showtime. Upper zones of discomfort in terms of the 3.5 pounds of electrical energy between our ears, our mind, are just as dangerous as lower zones of discomfort.
What are some of the major challenges you see amongst the high school levels? So obviously, that's our main audience here.
Yeah.
When you're working with high school level basketball players, for example, where do you see some of their biggest weaknesses or biggest flaws from a mental perspective coming out?
I really think that the mental skills, the mental part of the game, Adam, is sometimes at the high school level kept at arm's length. And I'm under no illusions. The mental part of the game is not the reason why athletes initially get into sports. They get into sports to be running and jumping and doing the great drills that an Alan Stein will throw at them, or the or Rick Torbett in regards to knowing about, you know, one of the best offenses in the country and executing that really well. They get into the game for all these different reasons. Most players at that age don't get into the game because they're that concerned about the mental part of the game. That's the hard part, Adam. That's the dangerous part. That there isn't really a plan in place. And forgive me if you've heard me say this before. I mean, different venues, but I always say that sometimes in a basketball season, things don't go according to plan. The reason why is because that plan never existed in the first place, at least from a mental standpoint. And any effective plan involves three really simple components. Now, forgive me for being a simple guy to look at it this
simple.
Simple
is good.
I think so too, that a plan involves the answer to three questions. Where am I now? Where am I going? And how the heck do I get there? And when it comes to the mental part of the game, we need to have a benchmark in terms of analyzing a high school player to say, you know, where is that young man, that young woman right now? And the interesting thing about basketball is we keep metrics on everything. We keep metrics on our field goal percentage, a free throw percentage, assist to turnover ratio, offensive, defensive boards, and the list goes on. But very rarely do I see at that level coaches and athletes actively getting metrics and a baseline level in terms of different aspects of mental toughness, such as their coachability or how well they rebound from mistakes.
But can that just simply be chalked up to the fact that that's tough to measure?
You know, it is a little bit subjective, but here's how I attempt to work with coaches and athletes to get past that subjectivity. I want a player to gauge themselves in terms of how tough they are. Now, we know for the average 14 to 18 year old, their ego is protected second only to life preservation, right? It's not gonna be the most objective thing. But I also encourage coaches to actually fill out an inventory on the athletes themselves. And here's where the gold is, Adam, that in that situation where a meeting then takes place between the coach and the athlete perhaps for the first time in his career or her career actually get to see themselves how someone else perceives them from a mental standpoint. And they've already gone through the process of kind of gauging where they're at from a mental standpoint using a bunch of different metrics.
Can you share some of those metrics? I mean, what are you measuring?
Yeah absolutely. It under the umbrella of those four C's that I gave, aspects of composure and aspects of concentration, aspects of confidence, aspects of commitment, I've broken it down into 16 components. And that sounds a little complicated, but when you actually look at the components, it's really not rocket science. When you're looking at their level of
poise. Let's talk confidence for a second. Go through that one if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, when I talk about confidence, I always say to an athlete that you will never, ever outperform your own self-belief system. And I want to measure an athlete's confidence in a practice environment versus their confidence in a game. I want to see where their confidence is on a scale of 1 to 10. Really simple measurement in terms of how they bounce back from mistakes or a bad call or a no call from a referee. So I want to measure confidence under many different circumstances. And again, I want to look at it in practice versus competition. And I'll give you another category. When you look at competitiveness, obviously that's a very mental thing. But I don't just want to look at competitiveness in terms of an athlete's ability to push through fatigue and positive pain, where most will say, well, that's a competitive athlete because they're willing to literally push through the proverbial wall. I want to break competitiveness down into two discrete areas. I want to see how that player plays against inferior competition in terms of their competitiveness. And I also want to see how that player plays in terms of equal or superior competition. So even competitiveness is actually broken down, because sometimes you look at a young athlete and you say, my gosh, are they competitive? You say, well, how do you know? I saw them play last night. Well, under what circumstances? When a player's competitive, he or she's going to bring their A game against the best in the country, the worst in the country, and every team in the middle. So I want to break down again these four C's into 16 different components, but it gives you an insight into a couple, three of those components.
Now, and I wish I could make this true. If I could take you to DeMatha on Monday to meet with our team, a couple of things. One, how would you get buy-in from a group of guys that you just readily admitted at their age probably aren't very open to the mental side of things?
Probably hadn't even thought about it before.
Yeah. And then where would you start? What's the starting point when you're meeting an athlete or a team for the very first time?
Well, the first question, a great writer by the name of La Fontaine once wrote this. Forgive me for getting all grandiose here and quoting some classical literature here. But
I read tons of classical literature. Bring it. Bring it.
But he wrote, when the heart is captured, impossibilities vanish. And what I mean by that is this. Every one of those young men at DeMatha, which is one of the elite athletic schools in the country, great academic school, they want certain things for their career. I want to be able to tap into that motivational base. I want to be able to tap into their motivational rocket fuel by analyzing what do you want out of your career. And of course, for most boys playing scholastic basketball, young men playing scholastic basketball at the high school level, they want to go to a big program, they want to go to a great school, preferably a Division I school. Many of them have that vision of excellence for their life, and for some of them, they want to go on to the next level. Well, I'm going to share with them some traits that are exhibited at that next level, both Division I, I'm talking Power Conference, and also in the NBA, and tell them, hey, you know, where do you stack up in terms of this metric and this metric and this metric? And if I were to have a conversation with your coach, would your coach agree with your version of where you stack up? So I want to let them know that you know what? Even though the mental part of the game, it can be dynamic, it can be fun, it can be inspirational, it can be motivational, but there you got to grind too. You know, the analogy I give, and forgive me, this is a bit of a worn out cliche, but it's almost like eating an orange, man. You got to get through some orange peel before you get to the sweet stuff. So there is work involved. And it's not just a question of bringing in a guy like me for an hour 15, an hour and a half, and just mouthing the words. You know, knowledge in and of itself is not power. And they say knowledge is power. That's truth with a small t versus truth with a capital T. Knowledge isn't power. Knowledge is only ever empowered through application. So it's more than just sitting down and listening and maybe even taking a few notes. It's about how you're applying it day in, day out. And that was the first part of it, of the question. And forgive me, there was a second part. Yeah. And it's late enough in the day that I
walk in and you're standing there and you have 15 varsity basketball players just standing, staring at you, and you're meeting them for the first time. Where do you start?
Well, first of all, I'm going to speak to the coach and I'm going to have an understanding in regards to a basic needs analysis. What the heck is going on with this team? You can have a group of young men and young women extremely confident. They've got that swagger. You like to coach. That positive arrogance. You just love to coach. But maybe there's an issue in regards to poise. Maybe there's an issue in regards to how they react to when an opponent makes a run at them. Which, welcome to the game of basketball. An opponent is going to make plays on you. An opponent is going to make a run at some point in the game or at multiple points in the game. So confidence may not be the issue. It may be a question of poise, how they respond to that. It may be a question of the mental routines they're running. So the very first thing I'm going to get to, Alan, is basically a needs analysis. I want to know what the heck does this team need? And sometimes you can have a team that is actually fairly solid in aspects of mental toughness, but there may be some things in regards to chemistry or leadership that obviously the mental part of the game, of course, dovetails into. Maybe it's an issue of integrity. Maybe it's an issue of work ethic. Maybe it's an issue of a no-excuse mentality or one of the X factors that I call your ability to actually breathe life into your teammates. And I stole this from Jay Billis. I really like this. And Jay actually accredited another coach that he stole this from. But Jay said that many individuals have been on a team. Very few individuals have been a member of a team. And it speaks to the fact that you've got a lot of players who participate in a lot of the practice drills. You've got very few that are great leaders and breathe life into their teammates. And breathing life into your teammates isn't necessarily this happy-go-lucky attitude where you're wearing a silly grin on your face 24 hours a day and it's highly skipping through the mountains. I'm okay, you're okay, we're okay. Sometimes breathing life into a teammate is actually holding a teammate with brutal honesty accountable in a way that actually calls him to task, but at the same time preserves his ego. And that's very, very difficult to do. That takes a level of maturity. And I heard a great definition of that one time where they said that a very mature scholastic and collegiate athlete, you know they're mature when the things they should do become more important than the things they want to do. And sometimes when you're holding an athlete accountable, you want to read him the riot act. That's in our inclination. It's human nature. It's how we want to hold athletes accountable. But it is a skill in regards to leadership to be able to hold an athlete accountable and yet still preserve their ego. And that's obviously some emotional intelligence there and some maturity. But there are smart ways to do that.
So we were talking about confidence a few minutes ago. Is there a perfect formula for the amount of confidence you should have? I mean, I'm guessing at some point if you go too high in the confidence scale, it becomes unhealthy. If you go too low, it becomes unhealthy. How do you define that perfect balance of not being arrogant, cocky, too confident? Where's that balance fall?
Yeah, Adam, you hit the nail on the head. It is absolutely a balance. I was speaking to a coach I was lucky enough to work with when he was at VCU, and also the timing of it. And I'm not going to take too much credit on air for this, okay? Because if I had 1% to do with that team success, then hey, I give myself a little pat on the back. But it was all Shaka Smart and it was all VCU. Their work their talent, what they put into that particular season. But that was the season they went to the Final Four. And Shaka Smart was talking about his experiences as a young coach, and he was actually rebounding for a young Earl Boykins, if you can remember that gentleman. And Shaka, as he describes it, if Earl was 5'5", that would have been a miracle. That he was, you know, it may have been a little bit closer to Tyrone Muggsy Bowes there. And he said one of the things he loved about Earl was that when the Olympic team was picked, Earl absolutely thought, and Earl was one of the last cuts, and he thought, I'm good enough to make that team. And I'm relaying this story directly, almost verbatim, from Shaka. I'm good enough to make that team. And when Shaka was rebounding for Earl, with every shot that Earl would miss, he'd be like, come on, Earl. Come on, Earl. You're better than that. And he was confident, believed that every shot should go in, but he also had that balance of being hard on himself. And there are some young athletes that don't. It's a great question, Adam, because there's a lot of young athletes that don't quite strike that balance. They think that even though that, you know, they listen to the expression, hey, you'll never outperform your own self-belief system, so that means that your confidence should be so high that it almost smacks of hubris, a level of irrational arrogance, versus those players like and again, forgive me for name dropping here, but I'm talking about some stories that were relayed to me. I'm spending time with Kevin Eastman and Doc Rivers, and hearing about one of the greatest bigs in the game today. I know he's on the tail end of his career, but with Mr. Garnett, and hearing how tough he is on himself, you know. And here's a guy with a big motor, in that, you know, he never has an off button. He's very, very confident, believes in his ability, but extremely hard on himself. You can always hear him talking to himself. Come on, Kevin. Come on, Kevin. What the heck are you doing? Come on, Kevin. You're better than this. And so even though he's confident, he's also very, very hard on himself. But he talks into himself in such a way that doesn't destroy his confidence. It's a very, very fine balance.
Another question, and this is one I get a lot in the performance industry, and I know people do in the general fitness industry as well, is, when should I start seeing results? If I'm going to start strength training and I'm going to start doing some vertical jump, when should I start seeing a change? I'm sure you'll have probably a similar answer, but how about an athlete or coach that says, when are we going to start to notice a difference in our team's mental toughness, in their composure, in their confidence, in their commitment?
Yeah, I'm going to take what seems like a cop-out answer, but it is genuinely from the heart. It really depends on where they started from. Do we have an athlete? I mean, let's just pick your particular field, Alan, in regards to the conditioning side of basketball, the speed, agility, quickness, strength side of basketball. If they're completely detrained, you can almost do anything with that athlete, and that athlete's going to make some cardiorespiratory gains, some strength gains, and so on. Now, you do the same work with a truly elite athlete. I'm talking at the Olympic level. And if you see a 0.5% of improvement, you know what? You've done your job and then some, because that 0.5% improvement could be a 1/10 of a second, or even 0.05 of a second in the 200 or the 400. In a similar manner, from a mental skill standpoint, initially when you introduce a player to certain routines that help them bounce back from mistakes, such as you introduce them to the ability to flush and fix and forget a mistake. So for the first time in their career, they've actually got a routine in place that can help them bounce back. You see amazing results. But you do that with a very seasoned NBA player, future Hall of Famer, and you're refining, you're enhancing some of the great things they are already doing. And so the improvements are actually incremental. Now, occasionally, you'll have a player that reached the pros, the NBA, that I've seen, and a couple of teams that I've had the privilege of working with, and I've seen this. I've seen a few players that made it to that level. And a lot of it, yeah, it was some hard work involved, absolutely. But talent was so high, athletic ability was so high, skill level was so high, they didn't have to rely at any point in their career at any elevated mental toughness concepts. And so for some of those players, you get it, they get introduced to this for the first time, and whoa, you see a 10 or 15% jump in their free throw percentage. And forgive the term, that's a pretty sexy jump right there at that level.
That's delicious.
That is, Alan Stein, that is delicious.
That is a delicious jump.
So as we begin to wrap things up, I'll give you a quick scenario, okay? You tell me what you would do in this situation, since we were talking about DeMath earlier. You have a player, he misses some free throws at the end of a championship game. Those free throws could have won the game. So he's going into the offseason with this kind of hanging over his head. I come to you and say, Spencer, I would like for you, if you would, work with this individual over the course of the season. He's a heck of a talent, being recruited all over. get him mentally back with it. He is heartbroken right now. Get him stronger than ever mentally for next year. What would that offseason look like? What would the conversation look like?
First, I'm going to give you a response, which is the concept. Then I'm going to give you the actual practical steps and drills. The concept first. I have to get that player to begin shooting free throws in the here and the now. Not based on past, not based on future evaluation, in regards to the time zones that player puts his or her mind in. DeMatha, obviously, we were talking about a guy here, put his or her his mind in, excuse me. That is critical. And I want the player to actually grade himself for every free throw he's taken in practice in regards to the extent to which he plays past versus present versus future. Now, let's get really practical in terms of some things to help execute that. There are three or four things that for every free throw that you ever shoot, you want mentally to be able to go through. Number one, you want to be able to settle emotions and relax. And I call that hype number. And even though we don't have time on air right now to fully explain and unpack the concept of emotional arousal and hype number, I'm going to teach that player where his individual ideal optimum hype number rests. The hype number, the very the few seconds of the Cliff Note version of that is that your hype number is the perfect balance between aggression and poise in the game of basketball. And on that scale of emotional arousal, how psyched, how amped, how hyped you are, every player executes their skills the best at a certain hype number. And very often when we lose poise, we get out of that hype number. And when we lose poise, focus is the next thing to go. Has almost like a domino effect in terms of sports performance. So the first thing I want to do is get that player to relax. The second thing I want to get that player to do is use, and I'm going to use an eye roll term in my field where people talk about sports psych. Do you notice we've not even spoken about imagery and visualization one time yet? Because there are some individuals that say, yeah, sports psych, it's all about imagery. That's an important sliver of sports psych, but it's just a sliver. So we're going to talk about imagery for just a few seconds. In terms of how that player shapes the image of that free throw in his mind is critical. And let me get really technical on you now, okay? There are two camera lens views you can have in your mind's eye prior to a certain skill. You can have an outside-in view where you see yourself shooting from a distance, maybe in the bleachers, executing a certain free throw. That's outside the game looking in. You can also have an inside-out view where the image that you have in your mind is from the vantage point as if the camera lens was in your own eyes. And everything you see in that moment in your mind's eye is from the vantage point as if you were actually in a game. Now, here's the research that will knock you on your rear end. Time and time and time again, when they looked at what chances a player has of taking an image and mirroring and reciprocating that image and making it reality on the floor, inside-out images are so much more valuable. So I want to train that player to have an inside-out view and to also feel his way through that image, hear the things he would typically hear. A leather basketball has a very, very unique sound on a sprung-loaded wooden floor. And it's very different when you have players on the court with you versus if you're on your own. I want to mimic exactly what that player is going to experience in his mind. The third thing I want to do is actually shape the inner script, the internal script. I want to shape, and I alluded to this at the start of this conversation, I want to be able to shape the sentences that player is using in his head. And again, it's going to do two things. One is it builds confidence. It reminds the player that he is clutch when he's on his A game, but it also distracts the mind and prevents it from shifting towards consequences and
outcomes.
Outcome, yes. And the final thing, and again, this really is difficult to explain on air in the case of just a few seconds, but there is something in my field called channeling. It's how an athlete focuses. And there are different channels you can focus on. You can focus on your hearing, your vision, your touch, taste, smell, your kinesthetic sense, your inner voice, your imagination channel where you see images, all these different channels. Clutch play, pressure play is predicated on focusing on the right channel at the right time. So right before that moment of skill execution when he releases the ball, I want him channeled in his visual channel, not on his inner voice, not on the past, not on the future. There is a way to train that. So I want to put those four things, 1, 2, 3, 4, in place. And I want to make sure they're in place for the entirety of the time, all the downtime, from timeout to free throw, or from dead ball to free throw. Now that sounds a little complex, but in the space of just a few seconds, once this is refined, this mental toughness routine right before that critical moment of releasing the free throw can be executed in just a few seconds. It just takes work and a little bit of training.
Wow. Awesome, awesome stuff, man. Now, before
did you follow that, Alan?
Yeah, no, I did.
I did too, man.
Because I've had the privilege of hearing him say that before, but it's some powerful, powerful stuff. Now, before we completely wrap up, let's call a full timeout with our guys from Better Basketball.
Thanks, guys. This is Rich Sislowski with another full timeout from Better Basketball. huge fans of Spencer Wood over here. He's a great friend and a brilliant mind. We're going to take some time today to go back over one of the topics in our last full timeout. We got a lot of feedback asking about our academic honesty policy, so I want to go over that real briefly with you. Every year, we have our players and their parents sign an academic honesty policy for our program. We go over it at our parents' night meeting, and we encourage discussion during that meeting on the policy. But it goes a little something like this. Every student's character is challenged on a near daily basis. To cheat or not to cheat, that is the question. While it may very well be rampant practice in high schools today for students to copy each other's homework, write each other's papers, and find ways to share answers on tests and quizzes, these indiscretions are not tolerated in our program. We reference our student handbook policy on cheating, and then we go on to talk about the policy for our basketball program. The policy for our program for any players found guilty by the school of cheating is as follows. The first offense includes consequences at the coaching staff's discretion as deemed appropriate based on the violation. This includes, but is not limited to, suspension from participation in practice or practices, extra conditioning, or completing projects to benefit the team. Any subsequent offense after that is a minimum one-game suspension per violation, along with any additional consequences at the discretion of the coaching staff on a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, there seems to be a place in our society for cheaters. One only needs to look at statistics regarding cheating in schools, the use of performance-enhancing drugs in sports, political doublespeak, and the now all-too-famous Ashley Madison scandal to find other examples. While we can't change most of the world, we can strive to work on our little corner of the world, and this policy should make our goal clear. While we realize that someday we may take heat for this policy, it's a heat we are willing to take, a battle we're willing to fight, and a cause worth fighting for. If you have any questions on this policy, feel free to reach out to us at betterbasketball.com. Until next time, best wishes from Better Basketball.
Thanks, Better Basketball. We appreciate your loyalty and support of the Hardwood Hustle, as well as your commitment to elevating our game around the world. Folks, please check out betterbasketball.com for their video on-demand membership and coaching courses.
And coaches, if you want to win more games, call Spencer Wood, but also check out Crossover. Crossover's video film breakdown service will help you win more games. Visit crossoverwithak.com today.
You got any more delicious final words for us, my friend?
What a privilege to be hanging out with you guys. I've really, really had a blast, fellas.
Pleasure's all ours, man. That was terrific.
Thank you for the invite.
Where can people get more information? Please give your website, your social handles, anywhere where people can get more Dr. Wood.
I appreciate that. My website is iceboxathlete.com. It is tipping my hat to a throwback player by the name of George Gervin, the Iceman.
Yeah.
They said was smooth and good in the clutch. So the company I created was Icebox. It's iceboxathlete.com. At Be Mentally Tough is my Twitter handle. Please either follow me or just send me a quick hi. Would love to hear from you. And thank you for the shameless plug. Last but not least, the program that I've created to help athletes and help coaches is called The Edge. It's available at Icebox Athlete. And I appreciate that. It's four DVDs that are all broken down into the same four C's I gave you. So one DVD is all about composure under pressure. One DVD all about concentration. One on confidence and one on commitment. And if I may, the cool thing that, and forgive me for the bias, the pride of ownership, the cool thing about the DVDs is that it's not just designed to attempt to be all me. There are some of contacts and some friends and some previous clients that have appeared on the DVD. There are names like Doc Rivers and Stan Van Gundy and Jay Billis and Billy Donovan and a whole host of other coaches from different sports where I actually get to sit down with them. I flew across country and interviewed each of them and said, what do you say to a team in a timeout? And you can sense they're tight. You can sense they're nervous. How do you relax that team? Or how do you relax that athlete? And hearing that from the vantage point of so many incredible minds and incredible perspectives was very enriching for me, and I think it will be for the viewers of the DVD too.
Great stuff. No question. The Edge is outstanding. It's a sound investment. Spence, once again, we appreciate it, man. You are the best. For Spencer and Adam, this is Alan. We sure appreciate you guys listening. Keep on hustling.
Peace.
Hey, Adam, what are folks saying about the Hardwood Hustle?
Provocative.
No, it's not. It
gets the people going.
Hey, Alan, why do you think people should listen to the Hardwood Hustle?
I don't know how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal. People know me.
There you have it, folks. Two legit reasons to listen to every episode. If you love the Hardwood Hustle, please tell a friend or a colleague or simply tweet it to the world. And if you don't love the Hardwood Hustle, please visit a psychiatrist or call me directly at 202-524-0875. Either way, we appreciate you listening.